What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off. Yoni Asia is the founder and CEO of eToro, the largest social trading platform in the world. He's been a Bitcoin proponent for almost a decade and was part of the team that built the original colored coins as well. In this conversation, we discuss institutional services, the rise of millennial investors, staking, SPACs, renewable energy, sustainable meat, gene editing, and retail investor behavior during the recent crypto boom. I really enjoyed this conversation with Yoni, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into the episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is Harvested Financial. Many people have been asking me about options, whether it's in the stock market or in the crypto markets. If you don't know anything about options, you should check out Harvested Financial. They've got great educational resources, and once you feel like you're educated, you can actually start to invest in options through the Harvested Financial Robo-Advisor. So basically what they've done is they've created a robo-advisor built specifically for options trading. Options traders may be hedging a position or trying to get some cash flow by capturing some premium, but ends up being that sometimes you just don't have time to manage all of your option strategies. That's where Harvested Financial comes in. You can go to harvestedfinancial.com/pomp to learn more, but basically using a robo-advisor for something like options may be a great solution for some of you. So go check them out, harvestedfinancial.com/pomp, an options-based robo-advisor that was built specifically with you in mind. harvestedfinancial.com/pomp. Go let me know what you think. Next up is Unstoppable Domains. Unstoppable Domains has partnered with Coinbase Wallets to add support for .crypto domains. That's right, you can now send pomp.crypto or some other .crypto domain to somebody and have them send you Bitcoin to that name. So when you go on the Coinbase wallet, instead of having to enter in the really long hex Bitcoin wallet addresses, that's that long stretch of letters and numbers on a Bitcoin wallet address, you can now just say, hey, send me Bitcoin to pomp.crypto, and that will immediately route the payment to the right wallet address. The thing is, just like with regular domains in the non-decentralized world, once somebody buys the domain name, you can't have it. So if you've got a name, whether it's your personal name, your company's name, maybe a username that you use, or some other word that you want to make sure you own, head on over to unstoppabledomains.com and you can pick up the domain today. Again, you can buy anything.crypto, and once you get it, nobody else will have it. You can then use that as your wallet address on Coinbase Wallet. It's pretty damn cool. I've got pomp.crypto. You should go get one as well. Head on over to unstoppabledomains.com. Grab a domain before somebody gets yours. unstoppabledomains.com. Lastly is Nifty Gateway. Digital art is here and it is real. I've been very clear about my interest and what my intentions here are. I've been buying up a lot of digital art. NFTs, non-fungible tokens, are selling for hundreds and thousands of dollars. The only platform I buy on is Nifty Gateway, which is an official sponsor of this podcast. They release content from the best NFT artists in the world twice a week, and they featured many world-famous artists, including Kenny Scharf, Trevor Jones, and Who's B. If you are into digital art or you want to learn more, go to niftygateway.com/pomp. Again, Nifty Gateway is where you can either participate in the auctions of brand new digital art, or you can buy art on the secondary market. I personally believe the digital art market is going to eventually eclipse the traditional art market, but if you want to start participating today, you can head to niftygateway.com/pomp and sign up for an account. Digital art is super interesting. There's motion, there's sound, there's all kinds of things that it can do that traditional art just can't do. It's small today, but I think it's going to grow a lot. So head on over to niftygateway.com/pomp and start learning about this new space today. All right, that's it for our advertisers. Let's get into this episode with Yoni. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys. Bang, bang. I've got Yoni here. Thank you so much for doing this, sir.
Thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
This is either your second or third time on the podcast, so I'm not going to waste a bunch of time going through the background. People can go listen to the first episode, but spend maybe 30 seconds on just what is eToro.
Sure. eToro today is the world's largest social trading network. We have over 16 million registered users who register to our social network where they can trade commission-free stock trading, cryptocurrencies, commodities, indices, ETFs in more than 100 different countries. And the unique part of eToro is you can actually see people's performance in their portfolios, and our users can automatically copy top traders from all over the world and invest in our copy portfolios. We've been doing this for a while now, founded in 2007, quite big in Europe and in Asia, and just recently launched in the US our crypto trading social network to start with, and plan to add soon our commission-free stock trading as well.
One of the things that everyone knows you for is obviously all the retail trading, all the retail products, but you've recently put a big focus on institutional services. Help us understand what exactly are you guys doing on the institutional side and how's that going so far?
Sure. So basically what we did is we had a surge in volumes in 2017 and 18 in crypto. So we had to build a lot of our own pipes because there weren't any real institutional players back then. So we had to build our own aggregator where we connected to multiple exchanges, to 10 different exchanges, to basically aggregate orders from multiple exchanges into our own order book. So when our customers, in some cases, came and bought $200 million of Bitcoin in one day, we'll be able to basically get these orders and, you know, distribute them between several exchanges. Of course, there's a lot of things like, you know, what's the credit risk? Some of these exchanges, or all of them, by the way, aren't public, right? So back then it was impossible to trade with highly regulated and sort of large financial institutions in crypto. So we had to sort of diversify the risk of how we're trading. And we built a lot of the technology, again, for us, because we had hundreds of thousands of customers who came into eToro to buy XRP, Ethereum, Bitcoin, and all the other currencies we support in eToro. And at some point we said, okay, let's take all of this infrastructure that we've built to ourselves. So military-grade, air-gapped custody solution. The fact that we're a regulated entity. The fact that we have our own flow, which is hundreds of millions of dollars a day going through our own internal order books, and simply let's put it out there as a product and tell other institutions, other brokers, listen, this is the infrastructure we're using for ourselves. You know, the best possible security because we custody a significant amount of crypto on eToro. It's regulated because we're a regulated broker dealer in five different continents. So we make sure everything we do is regulated as a financial institution. Obviously we need to give a great service and great pricing to our own customers. And you're getting it in a much lower fee when you trade directly with eToro X.
And so far, what's been the response and kind of adoption of those institutional products?
So we've seen a lot of institutions sort of evaluate the APIs or do the onboarding, and some of them buy and hold. So I think what we so far have seen is institutions eventually coming to sort of buy and hold, thinking about sort of custody more than anything else. I think what we're seeing now is a bigger interest. We're seeing more and more partners who are looking to figure out how do they connect it to their pipes. And again, that's what was what really are thinking when you look at DBS Bank in Singapore or the banks in Japan. So we built this so when traditional financial institutions want to connect into crypto, they understand that we can provide them the same services we provide to our own regulated entities. So there are a lot of conversations, there are a lot of accounts, but I think they're getting there. Institutions are gradually getting there to put in the pipes in place. I think that's also what we're seeing now in this rally that we're seeing in Bitcoin. I think we're seeing this rally because some selected institutions said, okay, let's put a pedal to the metal. Let's set up the infrastructure, whether it's PayPal or whether it's Square also announcing they're buying out of their treasury, or MicroStrategy buying out of their treasury. Obviously, the devaluation of traditional fiat currencies helped that as well. But I think our expectation is we'll see more and more traditional financial institutions coming in and eventually connecting the pipes to their either retail or institutional customers. And we just want to provide them with the same backend that we're providing ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think this is part of this larger trend of, you know, 10 years ago or 8 years ago, it was all the conversation around like criminals, drug dealers, terrorists. That's what crypto is for. You know, these people are all bad people. Keep this out of our banks. Keep this out of our portfolios. Maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you started to see people saying, wait a second, like, what is this? Let me get educated. Now it feels like there's just this bonanza of large asset managers, large financial institutions that are saying, I have to do something here, right? Even the JP Morgans of the world kind of releasing, you know, all sorts of analyst letters about their belief in kind of the future price appreciation and kind of the demographics and things like that. So it just feels like things have gotten much more legitimate in the eyes of the legacy market. You've been doing this longer than almost anybody, literally from like, what, 2011, 2012. Yeah. How do you think about where we are in terms of that arc of legitimacy and kind of how these financial institutions now are warming up to this?
So I think, again, first of all, I love the Goldman and JP research on Bitcoin. I just enjoy seeing their logos of their research talking about Bitcoin. And their views are getting better as well, by the way. I think the pandemic, everybody's talking about how the pandemic has accelerated digital transformation, right? Suddenly everybody's at home. The last time we did this was in person. Now we're doing it on Zoom. People are closing deals. Everything is online. You know, we've seen a surge of 200, 300, 400% in different KPIs this year, more than 4 million new registered users to eToro. But you can see the stock markets as well. Everything that's digital has become the hot thing of the markets because suddenly everybody's using digital to do anything, whether it's trading or investing, or whether, you know, it's suddenly my father and mother who are now suddenly buying constantly on Amazon and AliExpress. And traditionally, they were actually going to the stores. So, and I think we are seeing the same acceleration of digital transformation in money. They are looking at this and saying, okay, let's make sure we don't miss this train because something real is happening here. Take into account that VPs and managing directors now at all of the large banks are our age. So, you know, millennials are taking over the executive positions in the banks, the decision-making positions in banks and financial institutions. And they're much, much more open to crypto. And on the other hand, we have a macro shift in fiscal policy. We have a stimulus of $6 trillion in the US. Like, I can't count in trillions anymore. You know, I used to be always, I made fun that assets under management in the world are 140, I think it's trillion dollars, right? So that's such a big number. But now you're seeing governments print in trillions, Europe, Asia, everywhere. Now that printing is basically devaluing fiat currency. And that is a discussion that more and more people are talking about. I heard from one of the bank's analysts yesterday, he said something very interesting. He said, listen, you need to have an asset in your portfolio that's a real protection from central bank policy of money printing. And Bitcoin represents that on a macro view. And I think more and more institutions are getting that. But I think we're way, 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 way early in the adoption of crypto, or specifically of Bitcoin, as a store of value. Loved how JP looked at it and said, listen, if it could be gold, it could go 10x. But again, if you think about, I don't know, how would you compare Google before Google was Google, right? You couldn't imagine its size. So I think comparing it to gold, saying it can go 10x, then you can also think, okay, but what if digital gold is actually better and bigger than regular gold as a store of value?
Yeah, I absolutely say all the time, like, it is more likely that we are all underestimating how big this will get rather than overestimating it, right? It's just that when you look at things on a global basis, the power of the internet, the number of people, right, already is big, and then it's only getting bigger over time. And when you start to think about an entire demographic of people basically waking up and growing up with the idea that they want digital goods rather than kind of physical goods, it's just really hard to kind of compartmentalize those different trends and understand how big it gets, right? So I completely agree there. What have you guys seen people doing during the recent rise, whether it's in the stock market or in crypto? Like, are there changes in behavior that are very obvious to you? That you guys say, look, you know, in our data, we're seeing X or Y happen?
Well, first of all, again, this year has been the year of the rise of the millennial investor. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's seeing it. Well, you know, we're seeing, if, you know, when we saw the crypto rally, it was the crypto rally. Like, it was like a zombie attack on eToro. You know, people climbing over the doors, opening accounts, coming to buy Bitcoin. Then this year, it's really, I think the rally is about an entire generation waking up to the markets and saying, I want to do something with my money, right? So this entire year, everywhere, people are talking about stonks. People are talking about investing in the markets. The markets have been crazy interesting. Crypto has been interesting as well, with a very wide range. And now, at the peak since the bubble burst in 2017. So I think this really is the year that's opening up the millennial investors to start investing both in the markets and in crypto. Because we were so big in Europe in crypto in 2017-18, what we saw, which is really interesting, is how many of these Bitcoin, ETH, XRP hodlers suddenly started trading stocks this year, and what stocks did the crypto holders buy? And what's interesting is their affinity to driverless cars, to Tesla and to NIO. So those are the, you know, for a large period this year, the most traded stocks on eToro. So you can say that crypto lovers, which is sort of right, they like digital currencies and digitization, and maybe blockchain is like a comparison for driverless cars AI. So there is some connection between the two, but that's very like interesting to see how Bitcoiners are also Teslars. Other than that, I think, you know, we've just seen a lot of users look for the deep during the pandemic. By the way, the same with crypto. So I think when we saw March, we saw Bitcoin, did it drop almost to 6,000, right?
So in March, it went just below 4,000 at one point for a second, I think.
Oh no, why didn't I buy? Wow, really? It went that deep? Yeah, that's like one of the biggest things this year is to say, why didn't I buy in March more stocks and crypto? So we had that fear when the markets panicked. For us, it was an insane month, both in crypto and in the stock. So when all of the institutions, and that's so interesting to see like the dynamic between, you know, panic and hysteria, and how different audiences, or how do different age demographics and institution versus retail, sort of how do they react to panic and hysteria, right? So there was a panic. When I say hysteria, I mean positive hysteria. Like the market's going up this week, 5 or 10%. So when we saw the panic in March, we saw, I think, institutions pulling out money, right? So all of the institutions were de-risking, saying, wow, there's a pandemic here. What are we going to do? put all of the money in cash. Nobody knew the size of the stimulus effect. And I think what happened there is that asset managers that had crypto still held crypto as a risk asset, which is interesting because that theory that we Bitcoiners like to say that Bitcoin is a great hedge to the portfolio cohorts, it's uncorrelated asset, and because it's basically de-risking central bank printing of money, so it's a hedge against governments. So I think that statement, I truly believe in it, but that's not necessarily the reason or the bucket where a lot of the institutional money went in. I think institutional money initially went into crypto not as a treasury hedge, but as a speculative a wager. So somebody young at some of these institutions said, hey, let's do this. Everybody's talking about crypto. Let's be in crypto. Let's buy 50 million or 100 million for crypto. And I think when we saw the crunch coming and everybody going to panic, a lot of people sold. And that's why we saw crypto drop so much, because they all tried to simply de-risk their portfolios. And I think what we're seeing now suddenly is investors actually coming in from that different perspective. They're coming in as a treasury asset into Bitcoin. What's really interesting that we saw this year, and that's crazy, and I know we've put a lot of data out there, there was a lot of data out there, is discount stocks. So in March, when everything dropped, was the highest revenues month for eToro since the crypto in 2017, where we had in 1 month $100 million revenues. So this was like 1 month just blown out of proportion of just retail investors coming in and saying, whoa, 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 why is everybody going out of the market? What really changed? And they bought everything. Like we saw retail investor buying Hertz, FedEx, Airlines, Boeing. Like our top 10 traded stocks back then was stocks that went down 80, 90%. Mm-hmm. And that was awesome because, by the way, recently they all made a lot of money, right? Because of the rebound. But that's also telling you the story of crypto in the markets, right? Retail investors can take, by definition, higher levels of risk because it's their own personal money. They're not managing other people's money. And that's what they did this year. They came into the market. They tried to save companies going bankrupt, which is an amazing story that I don't think has ever happened before, and became a significant force in the markets. I think from about 10% of volumes in the markets, retail are now 25% of volumes in the markets. So that's a very big shift towards retail. And I think if you think about crypto, it's the opposite, right? I think it's 80, 90% retail now. And gradually we'll see institutions coming in and taking a bigger piece of the pie.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about kind of this millennial investor. And I think that millennial investor and retail are somewhat interchangeable. But what else have you seen those millennial investors? So you mentioned, you know, crypto, obviously. There's Tesla. There's what I'll call a lot of like the pandemic stocks. So whether it's the Zooms of the world, the Hertzes, you know, all those stories that people have heard. Was there anything that was really surprising or anything that maybe people don't know that the millennial investor was interested in that you guys were seeing?
I think, and that's a part of how we're building the copy portfolios on eToro. So whatever we're seeing and saying, hey, that's interesting, we'll actually set up a portfolio on eToro so investors can get access to sort of that data. So renewable energy was a very big thing this year. So we've seen a lot of our clients going into companies like SolarEdge. Unproportionate amount of assets in eToro are going towards renewable energy and sustainable investing. So the likes of sort of Beyond Meat, Tesla, NIO also are in that category. So electric cars. So we definitely saw the audience sort of looking for disruptive technology. We saw them going into gene editing, which is sort of both. We created two copy portfolios around that. What is about around the vaccine companies? So also unproportionate, you know, drug companies were so boring last year. Like if I would try to talk to you about Pfizer or Moderna or Gilead, you would be like, you know, who are they? Suddenly we have retail investors who are analyzing the financials of Pfizer and estimating how much money they're going to do from the vaccine for COVID. And what's interesting in these things is if you think about retail investors suddenly analyzing, and we see this really interesting, like on the social network, giving a full analysis of suddenly drug companies and comparing them to one another. That's very interesting because that means retail investors aren't only exposed to what we've seen so far, which is the FANGs, right? The FANGs and Teslas, etc. Suddenly, because of the pandemic, they went into things like drug companies, which is a big category, healthcare, health tech, big category of the S&P, but also into utilities, into airlines, and into leasing companies, and into Boeing and Airbus. Airbus was the most traded stock in Germany for like a month or two earlier this year. And that enables more people to both impact the markets, but also understand what's happening in those companies.
Yeah. It's really interesting when you also look at those things don't seem so risky to that millennial investor, right? When you're talking about gene editing, when you're talking about renewable energy, when you're talking about sustainable meat, I think that most people are like, of course, right? If you're under a certain age, it's just, of course, that's going to happen. Very similar to, I think, you know, Bitcoin. That's why the younger demographic is just, of course, digital goods are going to be a thing. Of course, these trends are going to happen. And so it seems like they are putting their money where their mouth is to some degree, right?
And they're all making money this year, which is great. I mean, that's always a good, you know, people coming into the market, making money, becomes viral. They talk to their friends about it. More people are coming in. They're learning. There are better tools today than there were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. They're communicating with one another from all over the world. So I think we are seeing a real new sort of era for capital markets. Which is, you know, what we've been chiming since 2007 is, you know, open the global markets for everyone to trade and invest in a simple and transparent way. We're just seeing it happening now. And, you know, and it's funny because it took me, you know, Warren Buffett to hit my head with how easy capital markets are for me to feel comfortable shouting that more and more now.
I love it. Before we get back to crypto, the last thing I want to talk about in the kind of traditional market is SPACs. It feels like everyone has a SPAC, and there are, you know, all these transactions happening. You're seeing people speculate on basically who the SPAC sponsor is. You're seeing kind of great performance post acquisitions or post deals. What are you guys seeing when it comes to SPACs, the trading of them through client portfolios, and kind of just how that market is maturing?
So first of all, SPACs of 2020 are ICOs of 2017. So they institutionalized ICOs into capital markets, and that's roughly what we're seeing. So, they raised $60 billion of dry powder to SPACs this year. SPACs were traditionally, you know, blank check companies who went on to try and buy brick and mortar companies. There were a couple of sponsor groups in 2018 and 19, which sort of led this change in dynamics for SPACs to invest in high growth companies. And over the past 12 months, that entire narrative just took off and blew out of proportion. And I think a lot of the sort of ecosystem is because how it's built. I think most people don't really understand how SPACs work. So what we have is great examples of successful SPACs, whether it's DraftKings, which was an awesome, one of the most successful SPACs earlier this year, whether it's things like Virgin Galactic, which is a huge story. There were a lot of successful SPACs over the past 12, 18 months. They all start in $10, and a lot of them sort of suddenly were at $15, $20, $25. So it legitimized significantly the entire sort of vehicle of SPACs. And I think it also attracted a lot of very talented sponsor groups who said, hey, there are great companies, there are great private companies, We saw a huge increase, by the way, as you probably know, in private placements, an increase in VC. There are more and more mature companies. I think last time we talked, we said, you know, there are so many mature internet companies who are private right now, raising $100 million and staying private. Now there are more and more companies who are generating $500 million revenues and are still staying private. And SPACs is basically a tool of capital markets to sort of, you know, accelerate them being public. Take all of these private companies, a lot of them really great private companies, and take them into capital markets. And I think, by the way, this relates very much to what we talked before about the impact of retail investors in the market. So when you think about taking sort of higher risk profile, higher growth profile companies at higher valuations through SPACs to the market, then the fact that retail investors are there and participate in it, it's a great opportunity because you can't get into IPOs. It's like amazingly hard for a retail investor to get allocated to a successful IPO. And here you actually get to trade the stock of the SPAC prior to the deal being done, right? So a SPAC closes a deal with a target, and until that, you know, month before signing and closing, you have this trading, which is interesting because they're trading on the basis of this SPAC is going to buy this company. I believe in this company, and that a lot of shares are changing hands and retail investors are participating in that as well. And some of the SPAC shares, some of them, you know, Nikola was a very big story this year. So there was a couple of really big retail stories coming from SPACs this year.
In crypto, what are the areas that you're most interested in, right? You've obviously been a Bitcoin holder and fan for a long time, but what other areas are you paying attention to or interested in?
I think, you know, I was always a big fan of ETH. I think moving ETH to staking is super interesting. Having a sort of, let's call it ETH risk-free asset that generates 5 to 10% returns. I think that's super interesting, especially again, thinking about macro of fiat, right? Fiat is 0% returns. You're buying now bonds of Berkshire Hathaway with 0% interest rate. So I think that having something as big as ETH, which is, you know, I think it's $42 billion market cap now, suddenly giving, think about the size of what they're giving, right? 5 to 10% a year to their holders. That's $2 to $5 billion of ETH being distributed, not to miners, which is complicated and requires you to buy stuff and to buy hardware, but just to the holders of ETH. That's a big paradigm shift in crypto, I think. So very interesting to see what's happening there. We see its progress. I think because our interest in staking, we also started staking services in eToro. So we started with Cardano. It's also interesting to see like how our customers who have Cardano on the platform were banging the doors for, hey, can we get staking? Can we get staking? And we had to like, they're shouting at us to give them staking, and then we need to put like 10 engineers for half a year to figure that out because it's still in alpha. But it was fun. Like it's because of that, we've participated in a lot of these early stages of the staking protocols like we're doing in ETH, like we offered Cardano. We're going to launch very soon Tezos, which has a very different view of staking, which I think also is interesting. And I like what they're doing at Tezos. We're seeing Tron. I think we're already giving staking. So I think staking is a big part of what's happening now in crypto, and it forces also us and the companies offering crypto to sort of connect more to the rails, to the platforms, to the blockchains themselves. And obviously, you can't talk about crypto and what's going on without DeFi, right?
What on the staking product, what are you seeing in terms of the interest from people? Is that something where it's specific to a protocol or is it kind of there's widespread interest across all of the different protocol groups that, that they really want this?
I think we've seen the most interest coming from the Cardano investors on eToro. I think ETH is a bit earlier stage. I you know, it's also very complicated because you need to lock it up. So it's going to still take a while before people, I think, expect it because it's sort of like a, I don't know how to call it, schmork with the whole ice age and, you know, locking up the ETH for a year, etc. So that's very, that's still complicated for most people who are in ETH. I think we haven't heard that from them. So that's the loudest voice we've heard is from Cardano. I think a lot of the community there was really interested to see how they're moving from testnet to mainnet with their staking services.
Got it. And on the DeFi side, are there specific things that you guys are going to try to build into the product or do there that, this is a big divergence from the stock market where everything's pretty straightforward. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. What are you thinking there?
So first of all, we're following a lot of the action. So we like wherever we see action and people, where you see crypto Twitter screaming and shouting, you know, you need to at least take a look. So we'll be adding a couple of these interesting DeFi protocols soon onto the eToro platform. So far, we were very focused on blockchains, but I think gradually these DeFi tokens are somewhat becoming similar to protocols, just without the, you know, without the metals, right? So if you think about it, all blockchains require computers and mining and, you know, some hardware. And these DeFi protocols just, you know, are just sitting on top of ETH mostly. So it's like progressing from hardware to software. I'm a very, very big believer that code is going to change legal sort of mumbo jumbo. So, you know, lawyers and accountants eventually. So if you could do a transaction in code rather than lawyer, you know, 200 page legal agreements between three different parties, I'm a very big believer in the future of DeFi. I think tokenization should happen first before DeFi can really happen on large scale. But I think what we've seen this year in DeFi is sort of a micro world or microcosmos of the entire banking industry, right? We've seen loans, we've seen flash loans, we've seen interest yielding accounts, we've seen sort of mortgage backed securities, which are, you know, or CDOs, which is sort of what's happening with Maker. So you've seen sort of every single financial innovation that you've seen in Wall Street. But, you know, that requires a lot of suits and lawyers and just being done between financial institutions. I think you've seen all of that sort of crystallized into a developer chef saying, hey, let's do something crazy here and just launching it and suddenly have a lot of finance geeks using it, pumping it, moving it. And it's super interesting. I think that's how finance is going to look 10 years from today. I just think right now it's still, you know, it's a microcosmos of testing, developing, launching, and using it all at the same time by really, really smart people.
Are you worried at all that we may be having a repeat of the 99 like internet bubble? And what I mean by that is if you go back to the, you know, mid to late 90s, all those ideas were actually very valid and ended up being highly successful companies. It was just the, you know, music streaming, the grocery delivery businesses, like all of the ones in the mid to late 90s ended up not being the winner. It's almost like 10 years later is when they actually got built and those were the sustainable companies. Does it feel a little bit like that is happening in DeFi right now where it's like, these are the right ideas? And I agree with you, you know, 20 years from now, we'll be like, wow, this is amazing. But maybe these iterations aren't going to be the sustainable one? Or do you feel like there are some that can be the winners, you know, that are being built today?
So first of all markets work on the notion of bubbles and bursts. So This was my thesis in my first degree, was basically a gaming theory that if you actually put agents and you build just a market of bots, theory information, all they know is what everybody else is buying and selling, and you computerized it, I actually ran a simulation of it, you get to see, and all the bot knows is look what everybody's doing, decide whether are you buying today the asset or are you selling today the asset. It looks like this, going up, 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 up. Because at this point, everybody says, hey, everybody's making money, so what I should really do is buy now, then up, 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 and then down like this. So that's like in theory of markets, that's how markets behave. They go up for a long period of time and then drop very sharply, very fast. Is DeFi specifically in a bubble right now, or does it justify the valuations of the tokens? It's very hard to say because it's still very small, right? So market cap of all of the DeFi protocols are still very small. And in most of them, there are logical sort of revenue generators, right? So they're all basically complex financial instruments who sort of take money, put money in other smart contracts, create some type of arbitrage or enabling others to create some type of arbitrage or take a market risk like Uniswap. So take a market maker risk, right? Again, it's what's funny is if you look at each of these protocols, you can compare them to something from, you know, you take a Goldman Sachs and there's a department, an entire department doing manually what one smart contract in DeFi is doing. So I think the answer is prices can definitely still go down, but there might be winners as well in the group of DeFi protocols we're looking at today. But again, we've seen what happened with was it Sushi who got slashed? Sushi, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What are you seeing when it comes to the institutions in DeFi? The institutional services you guys are building, will that include DeFi stuff in the future? And has there been interest from the institutions in that, you know, kind of subset of the crypto market?
I think so far we've seen more institutions looking into, you know, staking because they're saying, hey, here are yields. How do we get our yields on these protocols? From institutions in DeFi, I think it's a lot in the research. So when we talk to financial institutions, they're all excited. They all have blockchain teams right now, right? So all the big banks and financial institutions and institutionals are thinking about sort of how do we tap into blockchain? How do we connect? So they're all hungry for information. They're hungry for potential sort of product integrations or testings, but I think we're, you know, I don't think we're going to see institutional demand for investing in DeFi protocols or in sort of the DeFi itself yet.
Yeah.
There's also a range of financial institutions, right? So 25-year-old guy who made $1 million in crypto consoles himself today in financial institutions. So
of course. What's interesting to me too, I think, is like if you go back and you look, you know, I don't know, maybe in the 80s, right into the 90s, a lot of the hedge funds that are today the Goliaths of the legacy financial world, you know, they started out with just a couple $1 million. And so, you know, you kind of look around the room a little bit. And one of the conversations I've had with people is there are some crypto funds that are, hedge fund in nature that will likely be the Citadels, the Renaissance, the, you know, name your favorite kind of large hedge fund of the future. And part of that is going to be just because they're merely trading an asset in a market that those guys aren't playing in yet and are unlikely to do anything in for some period of time, right? It's kind of like when those large hedge funds want to play, what do they go first? They go to Bitcoin, right? And then it's like, oh, what's this ETH thing, right? And then maybe they'll go to two or three others to get to, you know, SushiSwap. Is going to take a while, right? And that feels like a big opportunity for kind of the crypto native audience.
I think that exactly sort of, I was joking, 25, it could be 35 or 45. This group of, let's call them crypto hedge funds for a second, of people who got rich in crypto and now said, okay, what are we doing with our crypto, right? So At some point they said, oh, let's do ICOs. Then they said, okay, let's do new protocols, or you know, this, then that. Then they said, let's do DeFi, right? So it's a group of people sitting on, let's say, $100 billion. These are not the what I call financial institutions. These are not hedge fund managers. These are just the people who made the first $50 to $100 billion of crypto in the crypto space. And they have a lot of crypto, and they're looking for arbitrage. They're looking for yield. They're looking for interesting projects. And that as long as crypto keeps on growing, we're just going to see these guys constantly be the early adapters of the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are definitely the users. Onitoro, who we saw coming in on the eToro platform, buying in Bitcoin in 2015, and by 2019 saying, hey, I actually want to trade Bitcoin to XRP and Bitcoin to Tron, or, you know, I want to actually use the exchange rather than just buy and hold an asset. I want to do more with my crypto.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask, what do you hold? Whatever you want to say.
By the way, my entire holdings are public, right? So eToro is a social network. You can just go to eToro.com, I think it's /people/Yoni Assia, or write eToro and Yoni Assia, you'll get to see my entire portfolio. So I am now about, I'd say 50-50 roughly stocks and crypto. My biggest holdings by far in crypto are Bitcoin and ETH. So I'm 70% ETH, 70% Bitcoin, 30% ETH roughly. And then my stocks are extremely diversified. Any product I use and like, I buy its company. So, you know, I do have some Tron. So I bought some Tron when I went with Justin to meet Warren Buffett. So I have some Tron. Blockchain where I know the owners, like Arthur from Tezos, I also at some point said, okay, hey, look, here's my Toro. Here's how fast you can buy Tezos. I think when I met him in a conference. So I have a lot of the smaller coins, but let's say it's about 10% of my portfolio. And then stocks, just anything I use, Disney, Coca-Cola, Jack Daniels, Facebook, Google, Netflix, Amazon. So all the usual suspects. Any company I use their products for a long period of time, and especially, by the way, if my kids use their products, I'll take a small allocation in my portfolio of that. By the way, when my kids start using Bitcoin, that's where the boom is going to happen.
Completely agree. I always ask everyone the same two questions to wrap up, but you've already answered those questions. So I have two different ones for you. We'll start with the fun one first. What is your favorite hummus? And this is coming from people on Twitter. What, I don't know why they're asking you, but what is it?
By the way, I'm guessing it's Howard Lindzen asking it.
It was not. Answer, and then I'll tell you who it was.
So unfortunately, and you didn't say anything about the fact that since the last time you saw me, I lost like 15 kilos. Unfortunately, I'm on a keto diet, or fortunately, I'm on a keto diet, which means I eat a lot of meat and no carbs, and hummus, unfortunately, is carbs. So I just eat a lot of tahina or tahini. It's almost as good as hummus. For anybody there in the US, I know really hummus took off, but tahini is as good. I use the gamal one.
All right. The other question I have for you is much more fun. I want to learn, which is, you went to dinner with Warren Buffett through this Justin's son donation. I think it happened, whatever. What was the biggest takeaways that you had, or the lessons that you learned talking to Warren Buffett for a prolonged period of time?
So what's personally amazing for me is, you know, I've spent my entire life on opening access to capital markets because I believed retail investors should be more active in the retail space. But it was always, I had this you know, fear of shouting too loud and telling people, listen, investing in stocks is easy, and it's easy to make money in the markets, because people always tell you, don't tell that to people, you know, be, you know, put your disclaimers, da, da, da. I think my biggest aha moment sitting with Warren Buffett is, you know, I read a lot of his books, and he says, by the way, in his books, exactly what he says in person. So I highly recommend reading a lot of his books. But he says, listen, if you look at the stock markets and you identify companies who you believe will just get stronger, who have a moat around them, right? So you believe in their product, you look at their financials, you can read their investor relations page, which people can, and it's really not that difficult to understand how to invest in capital markets. He's just reading public materials. And if you can understand that and read that, and you can make the right decisions to invest in companies you believe in companies that produce products that you believe in, and you will generate double-digit returns over a long period of time. And that's just, you know, and I think that's what's happening. Investors today, millennials, are suddenly realizing I should use my money, because when you're compounding, you know, 20% returns for 30 years, you know, it's a mind blowing figure. So I think that's the, you know, and he's been saying it in books. I've been reading it for years, but sitting with him and hearing it from his mouth, and like at some point, I'm like, I can't believe it. That's what he's been saying all the time. That's like the purpose of what we're doing in eToro. And like until that point, I was afraid to just shout out loud, people should invest in stocks, people should read financial reports. If they make the right decisions, which isn't necessarily simple. So you don't need to sort of just make decisions out of your wazoo. But if you actually read and get educated, you can generate double-digit returns in the markets over a long period of time. And I asked him, do you think this is also correct now? If I would give you the next 50 years to invest, would you still be doing the same thing? And he said that I would do it better.
Wow. Yeah. It's so simple, but people want to make it harder than it really is.
It's like everything. It's yin and yang, right? So it's simple, but it's complex. But again, I think we're seeing on eToro, we have now more than 1,000 popular investors who are being copied by others. The average IRR return rates for our top investors are 30 to 40% on average for the past 5 years. So, you know, they've been killing it, by the way, combination of stocks and crypto. And that's why suddenly this year, the assets copying popular investors on eToro grew by, I think it's fivefold. So suddenly people are looking at them and saying, hey, this guy's trading for 7 years on eToro. He has a track record. A lot of them have this bump during crypto winter. So it's like, and I think that's really the awakening again of the millennial investor.
Yeah. It's awesome. Where can people go find you on the internet or find more about eToro?
On eToro.com. And when you're on eToro.com, after you register, you can just write in Yoni Assia and you can see my entire portfolio and holdings. And you can go and ask me, why are you holding this stock or that stock? Or why aren't you holding this stock or that crypto? And I'll be happy to answer.
All right. And my parting question is, what are the updates you want to give us on eToro itself in terms of user metrics, revenue, future plans, whatever you want to share, the floor is yours.
I have not come prepared to that question, but we've had the best year of eToro ever. So this year is going to be better and bigger than the crypto boom. So the Corona rally and the rise of a millennial investor. We've seen more than 4 million registered users this year. We've seen revenues more than double. We've seen assets of our customers almost quadruple. So like we've seen mind-blowing figures this year. And I think we're seeing sort of a glimpse to the future. So the new investors are flocking to the markets. And it's, you know, I'm so happy to see this. This is what, you know, why we've built eToro to see this moment in time of the digital transformation happening.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Yoni from eToro. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much, Pomp. Always a pleasure.